Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The federal government shutdown is over, but now Governor Rick Scott's reluctance to use state dollars to keep federal programs going during the shutdown have some asking whether that decision was just political gamesmanship.
He needs every vote he can, you know, get at the moment. He certainly doesn't want to lose the base, that is to say, the people who will do anything to make President Obama look bad.
Also this week, state officials get an earful on Common Core learning standards during 3 days of public hearings across the state.
When it comes to school and education, I send my children to school to learn the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, not all the other rubbish.
We'll also have the latest on a teen suicide in Central Florida sparked by cyberbullying and how the computer chip in your phone is more powerful than those that run the state of Florida's entire accounting system. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. The great federal government shutdown of 2013 is now history. Some state governments jumped in to help cover some of the gaps as federal resources dried up. In Florida, though, Governor Rick Scott directed the state's agency heads not to use state money to keep federally funded programs going as the federal shutdown persisted. That despite the state's expected budget surplus in the coming year. As Regan McCarthy reports, that leaves some questioning whether the governor's actions are politically motivated.
Governor Rick Scott evaded most questions on the federal government shutdown despite the Capitol Press Corps' efforts to get answers, like at the shorter-than-normal media availability the governor held after a recent cabinet meeting.
Thank you, everybody. Ask you
about the tax cuts and the
The governor's office also denied several interview requests from Florida Public Radio, but his deputy communications director did send out a statement focusing on closed national parks, saying it was, quote, the federal government's obligation to reopen and cancel restrictions on Florida's natural treasures. But the welfare programs that help the state's most vulnerable residents also found themselves watching the clock as the nation neared a debt default deadline. The Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF program, had only enough funding to last through mid-November. But Department of Children and Families officials said funding for food stamps would run out at the end of the month. And for other programs, there was even less certainty. Department of Health officials could only say the Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC program, had enough funding for the, quote, foreseeable future. But when pressed on what the foreseeable future means, officials wouldn't elaborate. That worried some people, like Kim Ladner.
Okay, so here's formula. We have what? Two boxes of formula that'll last, what? That's about a day's worth.
Ladner's the director of the Emergency Resources Program at ECHO, or the Emergency Care Help Organization, which provides a lot of services for families in need, including providing food through a food bank.
So 2 days, I have maybe 2 days worth of formula at the moment. Wow, for one child. Yeah, and some diaper cream. Woohoo. Yeah, that's not going to go very far at all. And I can tell you right now that diapers, we only have size newborn up to about 15 to 18 pounds, and then we're out of all the other ones. We do have lots of adult diapers, though, so we're good there.
But she says supplies, like baby formula and infant diapers, aren't often donated to food pantries.
It's not something that we have a great deal of, mostly because formula is so expensive. Diapers are very expensive.
And she says that could also be because donors assume those in need will get those supplies elsewhere, from places like WIC. Ladner says she generally collects enough during a holiday food drive to last through April. But demand is greater this year because furloughed federal employees are now among those in need.
Some of the people that have been donors in the past may be very well the ones who are needing our services now. All of a sudden they get furloughed and they don't know where to go and what to do. And the ones that were donating to us, sometimes we see them come in with need.
And Ladner's Food Bank gets some of its supplies from the federal government. But new orders couldn't be made while the federal government was shut down. Meanwhile, a memo sent by Governor Scott's chief of staff to the state's agency head specifically forbade using any state money to cover such situations. But more than a third of the state's budget comes from the feds, so that directive loomed large during the 16-day work stoppage in Washington. But University of Florida political science professor Richard Scher says if the governor wants a shot at another term in office, he didn't have much of a choice.
Anything he does that helps out President Obama, or that makes somehow federal programs look good or keeps them going, I think, yes, he would lose support among his base.
Scher says Scott's conservative base is crumbling, and while he says those voters likely wouldn't vote for a Democrat under any circumstances, he says they would consider not voting at all, which Scher says would be even worse for Scott. And he says by not spending the state's money now, Scott has some leverage down the road to offer the $500 million in tax breaks that are the centerpiece of his 2014 campaign.
His whole thing ever since he marched into the state house is to reward his business friends and, you know, and give away the store.
But Scher says he's not sure Scott's gamble will pay off.
People need and depend on government, and to have this stuff shut down resources are available but not being used and instead are being used to help his friends in the business community. As I said before, I don't think people are that stupid. They can see this for what it is, political opportunism.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Floridians should know next month what changes the state plans to make, if any, to how it implements Common Core. The last of a series of public hearings on the new learning standards concluded this week, leaving more questions than answers. And as Lynn Hatter reports, education officials are pretty vague on what happens next.
What is clear are timelines. Florida Education Commissioner Pam Stewart says she'll take suggestions from the public and come up with a list of recommendations to give the State Board of Education in November.
I think what we'll plan to do is bring forward a summary at the November meeting for board members so that they can take a look at what kind of input we've gotten. Specific and general, both, and then gets kind of a census from the board of the direction they'd like for us to take.
And Stewart says the state should decide by March how to replace the outgoing Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test, or FCAT.
PARC is still one option that is out there that the state could elect to do. The end of the month, we will put out an ITN so that we can see what shelf or semi-shelf assessment might be out there, and then looking what other states have and see if there is some other state's assessment that we could piggyback on.
Florida and more than a dozen other states had planned to use the PARC assessment, but that plan was derailed amid criticism of Common Core standards aligned with the exams. And aside from decisions on the exams and recommendations, it remains unclear what will happen to the proverbial elephant in the room, Common Core. That uncertainty amped up this week, starting with a State Board of Education meeting where Stewart wouldn't even use the words. Uneasiness board members Gary Chartrand and Kathleen Shanahan picked up on.
That's, I mean, it's okay to say it.
Well,
Pam thinks it is okay to say it.
Well,
I think it is okay to say it.
About saying
the commissioner
really
is
do,
not
right?
comfortable saying that.
I will tell you that it isn't a completely accurate picture.
In recent weeks, Stewart has found herself in a position very few would envy. She's trying to please the board, which she answers to, and Governor Rick Scott, who, because he appoints members of the board, she also answers to. And serving two masters with differing views on Common Core is proving to be extremely hard. And let's not forget Stewart has a third constituency, the public.
Education in Florida is facing many challenges and has many barriers to overcome. Unfortunately, the only issue being discussed here tonight is the standards, and they're not the problem.
Through a series of town hall meetings across the state, education officials have gotten an earful from concerned parents, teachers, and others like Beth Mims, some for and some against Common Core. Catherine Bayer of the Tea Party Network opposes the standards.
Having the federal government suggesting and funding psychological standards and testing is an appalling violation of privacy and freedom of conscience, as well as the Fourth and Tenth Amendments. That is reason right there to reject Common Core national standards and the federally funded and supervised national tests.
Groups like the conservative Fordham Institute have pronounced Common Core to be equal to or better than the standards Florida currently has in place. And the fact-checking group PolitiFact Georgia has also told people to stop worrying Common Core will lead to increased data mining on students. Florida's been collecting data on students for more than a decade. And Tallahassee League of Women Voters President Rebecca Seeger pushed back on many of the other claims as well.
Concerns have been expressed that the federal government via the Department of Education is attempting to take over education, which is a state responsibility. We must remind you that the Common Core arose from a group of governors and educators, not the Department of Education. The U.S. Department of Education did respond to requests from that group of governors and educators to support Common Core.
Opponents say they'd ultimately like to see the state reject Common Core altogether. When asked about that, Commissioner Stewart did not rule it out.
Certainly that's input. So as I said before, we're going to take all of the input and we're going to make a determination of exactly where we want to head as a state as far as moving forward on rigorous standards for our students. So it's, as I said before, it's a little early for us to be able to determine that.
Florida adopted Common Core 3 years ago. It's now in place in some form in every grade level, with full implementation expected next year. The state says it's seeking to ensure Florida children have the highest standards possible, but it's hard to determine if schools are meeting that goal when officials are shying away from even using the name. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, law enforcement officers and drug addiction counselors partly blame Florida's prescription drug crackdown for a spike in heroin deaths.
This isn't a new problem of opiate addiction, and whether the opioids come in the form of a prescription or whether they're illicit, it's addiction.
We'll talk with a Central Florida Public Radio reporter who's been following a cyberbullying suicide case.
The suspect says that she didn't write that. Her parents claim her page must have been hacked, but authorities said they were so concerned about her lack of remorse.
We'll hear from critics of Florida's Stand Your Ground law who may disagree about what to do about the law, but agree the existing law needs to be taken off the books. And did you know the core of the state of Florida's computerized accounting system dates from the time the second Star Wars movie came out in the late 70s? Fewer Floridians died from drug overdoses last year than the year before, and the number dying from the prescription painkiller oxycodone dropped by 41%. But as Jessica Palumbo reports, at the same time, heroin overdose deaths nearly doubled, and people who work with drug addicts say they're not at all surprised by the trend.
Since 2010, Florida lawmakers and law enforcement officers have cracked down on so-called pill mills, those doctor's offices prescribing such large amounts of painkillers they'd been labeled drug pushers in lab coats. When the 2012 drug death report came out last month, State Attorney General Pam Bondi said the hard work is paying off in a big way.
Of the top 100 oxycodone dispensers, these are doctors. In the entire country, 98 of them lived in our state, and now we're down to zero.
Regional law enforcement strike force teams have partnered with the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency and State Health Department on the multifaceted crackdown. That's buoyed by new laws aimed at making it harder for doctors to prescribe the pills and for people to doctor shop, picking up prescriptions from several physicians.
Okay, does she want to go ahead and get dressed for her physical then?
But rules barring primary care providers from prescribing painkillers leave some, like Tallahassee nurse Elizabeth Markovich, frustrated for her patients.
People may have been controlled with just, you know, a few times a week of one pain pill at bedtime, but now they have to go to pain management for these kind of things. And the problem is that, for one thing, it's difficult to get into pain management. For another, often the pain management practice does not give them pain pills.
And she says when they do prescribe opioids like oxycodone, all patients must undergo random urine testing and other scrutiny aimed at preventing abuse of the addictive medicine. Several chronic pain patients have told Florida Public Radio over the past year they've had trouble getting pharmacies to fill prescriptions for oxycodone and other prescription drugs.
It is worse crisis than it's ever been.
Donna Ratliff, who runs the Florida Fight for Pain Care Action Network, says pharmacies continue turning people away.
Many, I mean many, will not fill anything for legitimate chronic pain patients.
Which is part of the reason law enforcement officers say they saw the spike in heroin deaths coming.
And as we in the law enforcement community focused on the pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. We understood that the importation of heroin is most likely going to kick up.
Florida Special Agent Supervisor David Gross has been monitoring drug trends in the state for about 20 years.
The cartels who traffic them into the United States, they see that. They watch that. And they know that there's going to be a void within that marketplace. So they start flooding the market.
He says people with an opioid addiction tend to gravitate to the easiest fix, whether it comes from a pharmacy or a street corner. So the number of heroin deaths jumped from 57 to 108 in a year. It's a small percentage of Florida's roughly 8,300 drug-related deaths in 2012. But Gross says with heroin use rising in every part of the state, law enforcement is fighting back.
The regulatory side of the house is cracking down on the bad physicians and bad pharmacists. So enforcement can then focus directly on the enforcement action of the heroin dealer.
According to state medical examiners, heroin is much more likely to accidentally kill people than oxycodone is. But Scott Teitelbaum, who runs the Florida Recovery Center in Gainesville, says it's an oversimplification to say Florida's crackdown is driving people to a more dangerous drug.
Yeah, is it more dangerous for you to be shot with a sawed-off shotgun than a handgun? Yeah, but I don't think you want to be shot with either gun.
That is to say, heroin is more addictive and easier to overdose on because it's usually injected or snorted. But he says all opioids are very addictive, and the only real solution is getting people into treatment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Another cyberbullying case turned deadly. Florida Public Radio's Stan Jastrzebski has that.
A Florida case of cyberbullying made national headlines this week. In our reporter talk back this week, we have WMFE reporter Nicole Creston. And Nicole, you've been covering this story. Tell us, first of all, what the latest is.
The latest is the announcement of the arrests. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd, which is the county in which the city of Lakeland is located, announced that he arrested a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old earlier this week. He said, in fact, that they'd already been building a case against them for cyberbullying in the wake of the suicide of an estranged friend, 12-year-old Rebecca Sedwick, in early September. However, he said, a post that turned up on the 14-year-old suspect's Facebook page over the weekend forced them into making an arrest sooner than they'd planned. In the post, with some explicit language that I can't repeat here, the 14-year-old suspect basically stated she knew she'd bullied Rebecca Sedwick into killing herself and that she didn't care, although the part about her not caring was a little more strongly worded than that. The suspect says that she didn't write that. Her parents claim her page must have been hacked, but authorities said they were so concerned about her lack of remorse, and they wondered if she could be bullying someone else or planning to move on to another target. So they moved up their timetable and arrested her and the 12-year-old girl.
And has there been any sort of response from the school district there in terms of trying to make sure this isn't happening on a wider scale?
The school district hasn't said much yet. But the mother of Rebecca Sedwick, she's starting an independent campaign to educate and inform people against bullying and cyberbullying. I've spoken to some parents as well in the Lakeland community, and they say justice is being served by the arrests and by the charges, but many of them don't necessarily advocate for jail time in this case, including Rebecca Sedwick's mother. I've been hearing suggestions that focus more on rehabilitation for the two girls, possibly community service in the form of helping other children to understand compassion or speaking out against bullying. But all of that is up in the air right now.
Do parents seem to think there's a larger problem here that needs to be addressed?
Some parents do. They say that this is not the first case of serious bullying that's happening within the school district. They say that there should probably be some kind of a district-wide program or a community-wide program to educate about this sort of thing. And a lot of experts are weighing in. They're advocating for more open communication between kids and authority figures like teachers or school administrators. They say that we should really work on changing the atmosphere of, well, if you tell, then you're a tattletale type of thing. They want to open more communication lines and invite kids to report to a parent or a teacher or someone in a position of authority that can do something about it, what's going on, so that other children don't get this far.
We hear a lot from state legislators and other state leaders that say, hey, look, it's tough to get ahead of technological trends, and it can be really difficult to legislate or to create rules when the way we communicate seems to be changing so consistently. I wonder if you've heard anything from lawmakers or from state education officials who say that maybe now there's a need to consider this on a holistic basis as to whether there need to be more rules, if we can even make rules about how we communicate on the internet, that regard communication, especially between minor students who might be classmates.
There are some experts and some parents that are lobbying lawmakers, and I'm definitely hearing them say that social media and smartphones are really changing the game when it comes to bullying. One expert I spoke to put it like this. He said bullying used to essentially be a Monday through Friday 8-to-4 proposition, and that's kind of how the school district is still looking at it. At that point, victims could get away, at least for the weekend, possibly give things a chance to die down. But now bullies have 24/7 access to their targets through social media, and that can really make kids like Rebecca feel trapped.
WMFE reporter Nicole Creston has been tracking this story throughout. Nicole, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate you being with us here on Capitol Report.
Thanks for having me.
A House committee that'll consider bills relating to Florida's Stand Your Ground law has decided when it'll discuss a bill that would repeal the controversial statute. As Sasha Cordner reports, the scheduling was announced the same week as a Tallahassee forum where critics sought to discredit Stand Your Ground.
Miami Democratic Senator Dwight Bullard recently refiled a bill aimed at making changes to Florida's Stand Your Ground law, a bill he says could have helped if it was passed earlier.
That would have prevented the acquittal of Mr. Zimmerman in the killing of Mr. Trayvon Martin, defining what an overt act is. The person would have to brandish a weapon, be charging towards another person, be physically engaged in acts of violence before one could use deadly force, as well as further definition of aggressor.
An explicit definition of who qualifies as an aggressor is a sticking point with Bullard, who says that's a major difference between the bill he sponsored and a similar bipartisan proposal that recently passed its first Senate committee. That Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy, being welcomed by Florida A&M University students at a forum discussing the law. He believes the proposed changes in the Senate tweak bill will help, but pointing to his son's situation, he says there's a difference between tweaks and making real change.
It's only two people that are involved in the case, and one is dead. Yep. So how can you determine who's the aggressor? So it has to be more than just tweaking it a little bit. It has to be more. You have to do more than just tweak it.
Second Circuit Public Defender Nancy Daniel says she's hopeful about the proposals she's seen so far in the Senate, but adds she wouldn't mind a repeal of the law.
Just the very language of that said to me that it was opening the door to a kind of a frontier justice mentality. And sure enough, that's what has happened, and I think it's very harmful. It will not bother me one bit if it is repealed, as long as we do not encroach on the traditional defense of self-defense.
But for Daniel's Second Circuit counterpart, State Attorney Willie Meggs, who's been opposed to the law from the beginning, he says he'd still rather have a full repeal than a fix here and there.
It fixed a problem we didn't have. It's created numerous problems we didn't need, and it needs to be repealed. And I'm for Alan Williams' bill, which repeals the law, not this mamby-pamby stuff that they're talking about in the Senate that means absolutely nothing to anybody, but it'll just make some folks over there feel good about being stupid.
A hearing is scheduled for Tallahassee Democratic Representative Alan Williams' repeal bill during the first full week of November, when state lawmakers next come back to Tallahassee. The House Criminal Justice Subcommittee will meet Thursday, November 7, starting at 3 p.m. The hearing, chaired by Shalimar Republican Matt Gaetz, is slated for 5 hours. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. There's no question the state of Florida is a big employer. It has close to 100,000 workers spread out over 35 separate agencies. All of those employees depend on paychecks generated by the same accounting system the state had in place back when Jimmy Carter was president. As Ryan Bank reports, watchdog groups, lawmakers, and former agency heads are raising alarms about the system's limitations and the possibility the whole thing could crash catastrophically.
The Florida Accounting Information Resource, or FLAIR for short, was created to manage the state's payroll, inventory, and expenses in 1979. And Christina Smith, the director of accounting and auditing at the Department of Financial Services, likens learning how to use FLAIR's 35-year-old software to speaking a dead language.
I had a cheat sheet that told me the numbers that I needed to plug in, and that cheat sheet was 50 pages long. And as I would do the bills, depending on what bill I was paying, I would know what codes to put in. So it takes time to learn the numbers.
The state pays to train programmers and users like Smith to learn FLAIR, sometimes taking as much as 2 years to get them up to speed. And Jack Miles, former secretary for Florida's Department of Management Services, says that's not the only extra expense associated with FLAIR. He says agencies often waste resources creating new technologies to make their own systems compatible with FLAIR.
So you have relatively modern technology in My Florida Marketplace as well as People First, and you have very, very outdated technology that you have to feed. Therefore, you've got middleware that you have to create in order to, my words here, kind of dumb it down.
So why hasn't the state moved to change FLAIR? Actually, it has, at great expense and to little avail. During former Chief Financial Officer Alex Sink's tenure, the state spent close to $100 million taxpayer dollars on a failed replacement. And Umatilla Republican State Senator Alan Hayes says that might make officials wary of another attempt to change the accounting system.
The staff that was here when that project bombed certainly remembers it. And you know, that's one of the fortunate things is we have very good staff working with us and for us, and we can rely a whole lot on what they say. There's definitely a very large precautionary attitude toward this next system.
Hayes, who is the vice chair of the Government Oversight and Accountability Committee, says lawmakers will examine other states' accounting systems and a study commissioned by the legislature last session that's due out in March to determine the best course for replacing FLAIR in the years to come. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.